This is the sound of heavy hail on the roof of our car. We are stopped at the side of a small dirt road in Kansas underneath a large rotating thunderstorm. Last spring, I joined a group of meteorologists and storm chasers on a trip through the central United States in pursuit of its notorious severe weather.
Been on the south side of this storm to see into it, because it looks like home to watch now, but I don't know what I'm driving through. I'm waiting for the update. Do you have radar? We had it briefly.
Oh yeah, there we go.
Where are we now? I think we should just keep heading east. Yeah, east. All right.
Yeah, we already have hail.
We got
hail. Hello, and welcome to the Met Aaron podcast. I'm Liz Walsh.
I'm Noel Fitzpatrick, and in today's episode, we are going storm chasing on the plains of Tornado Alley.
We are joined in studio by Met Aaron meteorologist Paul Downs, and we speak to veteran storm chasers Paul and Sarah Austin on why people storm chase and some of their most memorable experiences. Okay guys, so around the end of May, start of June last year in 2019, the two of you disappeared off to the United States to go storm chasing. Can you tell me how that trip came about?
Well, I suppose we should say first is that it was part of our annual leave. It was our holiday, so it wasn't some sort of Met Aaron trip, which is probably a sadder thing that we spent our holidays from the Weather Service chasing weather. But it came about, I guess, because when I came back to work in Met Aaron, I shared an office with Paul. And I think the first day I sat in there, he was kind of sizing me up to see would I be a potential storm chaser. What Paul wouldn't have known is that I think, as probably most people in this room, I'd watched Twister as a kid, and ever since that, I just wanted to go storm chasing.
What are you doing? What are you doing?
Look at the updraft, the angle. It's going to shift its track.
Are you sure?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely a sidewinder. It'll move left.
Is that bad?
Wasn't there a road back there?
You're right. Go!
One of my favorite movies ever.
Well, absolutely. That's why we're all here, I think. But yeah, so definitely the driver of this trip, though, was Paul. We had talked about it a bit in the office, and he had told me a good bit about his background in Oklahoma, where he had studied.
Yeah, I think they call that a busman's holiday, don't they? You know, so passion for meteorology drives us all the time. But yeah, my background, I actually was been interested in storms since I was a kid, and back watching the National Geographic TV shows on a Saturday evening and things like that drove my passion for meteorology from the start. Back in 2003, I got a chance to go storm chasing through a group in England. There was an online weather forum, and they were discussing the weather, and this opportunity came up at the very, very last minute to go for a storm chase trip. So over the space of a weekend, I decided, okay, I'm going, and the following Friday I headed off to Oklahoma, and from there it's just been non-stop. I went to the College of DuPage in Chicago for a while. We did some courses, some storm chasing trips with them in Canada and in the southern plains, from Mexico all the way up to central Canada and the plains. And in 2009 I actually decided to go out there and to start studying meteorology, just more on a casual basis to start with, but I fell in love with it and ended up in the University of Oklahoma, where I did my degree. And
And anyone who's interested in severe weather knows that the University in Oklahoma is the place to study that, right?
Oklahoma is the at the forefront of severe weather research, especially tornadoes. So it's like a mecca for weather nerds and storm chasers like myself. And from about 2009-10 onwards, I was storm chasing every year, every chance we could, in between classes. We'd go out and go storm chasing locally or through the plains of Oklahoma and Nebraska and Kansas and places like that.
And so where did you guys go on your trip then? Where did you aim for, or were you just going all around the place?
We were all over. We flew into Colorado, to Denver, but I think all up we hit 8 states. So pretty mm-hmm. much the whole midsection of the U.S. So we were in Colorado, Texas, Kansas, Oklahoma, Nebraska, South Dakota,
Wyoming, yeah. Montana.
Montana as well, mm-hmm. yeah. We
did that must Montana. Have been amazing.
Yeah, it was
beautiful.
It's beautiful. Sort of parts of the country that you often wouldn't go to, you know, as a tourist that you mightn't go to. So it was a reason to bring you there. And then you just spend days driving these amazingly straight roads through these plains.
A lot of people think we go storm chasing for, you know, the craziness and the adrenaline rush of going storm chasing. But to be honest, it's the beauty. The storms themselves are amazingly beautiful, but that country out there is just unbelievable, even on a good day. So on the down days, we used to go visit some national monuments and different national parks and things like that out there. And absolutely beautiful.
And so what was the day-to-day like then when each day when you went out? Was it, would you look at the models in the morning and then figure out where you were going to go and then just drive forever?
Pretty much. They'd almost start the days would start the night before, right? Wasn't that kind of...
Yeah. So the minute you get in the night before, you'd sit up and look at the last model run coming in and, you know, plan out where you wanted to be the next morning, because oftentimes things could change throughout the day you're on, and you get to the evening time and realize, ooh, I need to be 100, 200, 300 miles away from where I am tonight. So it depends on, you know, your start depends on that, if you need to get a lot earlier to go somewhere. But also, yeah, the morning time we'd wake up, we'd look at the models. Sometimes we'd get some the morning soundings, which is the first real image of what's going on.
And that's showing kind of the upper level, you know, conditions of the atmosphere, right?
Yeah, a sounding is basically, it's a description of the atmosphere from the surface all the way up to the top of the boundary layer, or top of the atmosphere, the weather-bearing layer. And it's basically just a weather instrument on the bottom of a balloon that goes up at a certain time every day in many different sites around the world. It's all aligned together and it gives us a picture of the atmosphere. So by looking at that, you can see and map out what the weather is going to be like for the next few days. So it's the realest image of what's going on right now. And
so then I guess we would use that information in the morning to sort of plot out a fairly wide area of where we would be aiming for the afternoon, right? And then by the time the afternoon comes around, then it's a case of just sort of constant repositioning, really.
Yeah, so you're narrowing in your focus area all the time. You'd have a fairly large area to start with in the morning. You'd pick a town or a county that you might want to be in, and you'd sit there, you'd have lunch, you'd have the computer out beside you, and you'd look at the latest models. You'd also look at the satellite imagery as the realest things what happening that day. So if there is a front that we're looking at, so a focus area or a dry line where you get dry air on one side and moist air on the other side, that's a focus area along that line. And you'd watch what the actual clouds are doing, where they're starting to build up through the middle of the day, and where the strongest focus of that build is. So all that kind of thing, we'd be looking at radar imagery to see if there's any storms beginning to go up.
The radar over there is fantastic. I mean, we would be driving around and they have a really high density of radar networks or radar units over there. So you have... We had a little app on our phone and we were just using that to tell, you know, you could see our little position on the map and then what the systems were doing around us, and you could plan quite well from that. And it's just this, I guess they're so used to getting those big storms there that there's a need for such a high density radar network there.
Yeah, especially through the Midwest where they get most of the storms, and from there towards the East Coast, there's a large density of radar networks, and they overlap to a certain extent so that, you know, you can get a good coverage of the whole area.
It's almost like, it sounds like it's kind of some crazy orienteering
Kind of thing.
It's like where you have to think about maps in your head and roads and all that, and then also you're doing the meteorology. So there's a lot of brain power going on.
There is.
I wouldn't like to do it on my own, to be honest.
The road navigation is as big a part of it almost, you know, finding roads. I mean, people who are experienced knew certain parts of these states and counties where, okay, the road network is good for this because, you know, you can go, it's pretty much a grid system, and then other parts, oh no, there's this river that's impossible to get across, there's only one bridge going across it, and local knowledge seemed to be very important.
And it's vitally important when storms start going up that you know what the road network is like, you know, ahead of the storm, so you can stay ahead of the storm and stay safe. So the navigator's position within the car is vitally important, probably the most important spot, and where we're going and what's how can we stay safe. I mean, at the end of the day, you don't want to put anyone in danger.
So when we were over there, we had there were a group of us there, so it wasn't just myself and Paul, and two of our team members were a brother and sister, Paul and Sarah Austin, and they've been storm chasing for several years, and they've built up really great experience and knowledge on particularly in storm chasing in that area. While we're on the road, I took the opportunity to talk with them for a while, and I interviewed them at this little cafe that we stopped off somewhere in the middle of Oklahoma. I don't know where, some little dust road. They were really interesting to talk to, and I started off by asking them about just a really simple question of what is storm chasing.
It's complicated in a sense because storm chasing for one person is not exactly storm chasing for another. But the elements of storm chasing really boil down to making a forecast and looking at other people's forecasts. There are a lot of resources online. Trying to position ahead of what may develop and adjusting throughout the day. Now, whether that is the purpose is to capture video for personal reasons, for research purposes, each person is different. There are people who the adrenaline rush of being you know, a little bit in harm's way and capturing something unusual is a big part of it. For other people, it's just the challenge. The tricky thing is that even if you're the best forecaster, you still have to navigate the roads that you're presented with. You have to make adjustments with the limited information, and at times getting data out in the middle of the plains is difficult. There's not cell coverage everywhere. The roads don't always cooperate. Sometimes the storms definitely don't stick to the roads in most cases. And so there is a challenge element. That's something that drives me. It's kind of like I compare it to someone who is into hunting a particular game or fishing. You have to some degree, you have to get to know the animal that you're pursuing, whether it's for photography or actually hunting, and its pattern, its behavior, and then the window of time that you have the best opportunity to actually experience it. And so storm chasing is very similar. We have storms that go up a certain time of day. They behave a certain way. Obviously, they deviate from that mean quite a bit at times, but we know the general pattern and we know what can happen. And you have a narrow window of a few hours. And if it's you're talking about tornado chasing in particular, sometimes you only have a window of a few minutes because the average duration of a tornado is pretty short. It's on the order of 5 minutes or less. There are tornadoes that are on the ground for more than an hour. So every storm is different. And I think that drives a lot of people too. There's the art aspect.
Another factor for me is the community, the storm chase community. If you go to the convention a lot or you chase a lot, you're going to eventually run into the same people. And so we just have some really good friends and we all watch out for each other and check on each other. Sometimes if we're stuck in the mud, which we hope not to be, but we'll help each other out, you know, take each other places, but truly look out for each other. So that's a big part of it for me as well, as looking at the structure and just the beauty of a storm in itself.
You were talking about the storm chasing community and the people you meet on the road. Is there a certain type of person that storm chases? Do you recognize a certain characteristic in the people that you're meeting on the road that you have within yourselves, or?
Well, the first word that comes to mind is what a lot of the storm chasers slash meteorologists call themselves as nerds, but just a weather nerd, weather geek, because you're looking at the computer and you're downloading models and looking at the models and researching it. But I would also say artsy, because there's a big part of it is getting the great photo.
You know, it's easy to say it takes a certain kind of person to be a storm chaser, and there's some truth to that. If you have great fear of severe storms, you're probably not going to be the one out there. Although I talked to someone yesterday who started out with a fear of storms, and it drove him to learn more and got into it. But I think really storm chasing encompasses a wide range of temperaments. You have people who, like I said before, that are big adrenaline junkies, and they want to get close, and they want to get the shot with the debris cloud really close. And you have people who their goal is to see as many tornadoes as possible, regardless of everything else. They're checking 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, counting their tornadoes, how many did I see this year, and so forth. And other people are more into the beauty of the storm on the whole, the storm structure. You have accomplished photographers. Storm photography is very difficult because of the lighting challenges. Obviously, you have researchers, whether they're tied to a university or to some other organization, or they're doing their own thing. Maybe that's what drives them. They're maybe the most nerdy. A lot of radar truck groups out there, mostly tied to universities, that have the Doppler on wheels vehicles, and they're trying to get rapid, high-resolution scans at different levels of a storm. I think the forecasters, a big part of it is honing their skill. Yeah. You know, that's something for me as a big drive is what can I learn to better understand what drives these storms and why this storm goes up and this one doesn't, why these two storms go up under very similar conditions, but this one produces a tornado and this one doesn't. And trying to understand that is a big part of it. And I learn as much from what we would consider failures as we do the successes, sometimes a lot more.
And also there's, going back to the research, there's different kinds of research. There's lightning research, tornado research, storm research, hail research. Like, that's a big thing too. And all of it plays a factor in this whole big animal, you know, the storm, the supercell.
So I guess one of your objectives when you go storm chasing is actually learning, right? Because you're learning each time you go out and you see something new and maybe compare it to past events and how it's different and how it was the same. What else are you hoping to get out of a storm chase when you go out?
For myself, I'm always trying to document what we see for my own purposes and as well as you said, learning. I have to remind myself sometimes in the moment when I'm looking at radar and other sources of information and trying to capture video, to stop for a minute and actually take in what I'm watching. Sometimes it's the opposite. I'm taking it in and I realize, oh, I didn't press record on the video camera. I'm enjoying it, but I do want to be able to watch it later. But sharing those experiences with other storm chasers, with other people, that sometimes we have an opportunity to take the video that we have and apply it to some of the research, some of the modeling, to find some similarities to help verify those things, computer models especially. I think also there are some humanitarian efforts that come out of storm chasing. So there's an organization called Storm Assist as an example, and they take just video and sometimes photography, but especially video from storm chasers, donated to the organization, and they'll compile it into a highlight DVD that they sell, and then that money goes back into communities that are affected. I know some storm chasers are trained and equipped for search and rescue and medical immediate medical help. We certainly try to be available without putting ourselves in harm's way. We have limited training, but just trying to help people. And then I think also one of the things that we do, Sarah and I, and a lot of storm chasers we know, is we get opportunities to go into schools and talk to young students who are studying weather. Maybe they have a severe weather section in their class, and we'll have a teacher who will have us come in and do a presentation, and maybe we'll talk about the threats that are involved with different types of severe weather and how you can stay safe. And then we'll share some of our video, some of our experiences, and that draws them in, because they oh, you got some tornado video, or you got some video of this, and they're interested. Usually, almost always, there's one or two people that are they're like a little me, you know, the mini me in this class. I can tell that's the one asking all the questions, and they're asking deep questions. And usually there'll be a few students who are terrified of storms. And my goal usually is to set their mind at ease. You can survive these things. And then for the mini me's out there, to inspire them. And even if they're not into storm chasing, to inspire them for whatever their passion is.
I love asking the kids, how hot is a lightning bolt? And they're like, 10 degrees, 100 degrees. And then a lightning bolt can be hotter than the surface of the sun, like 50,000 degrees. And that just blows their mind. And to talk about the largest piece of hail that has fallen, it's about the size of a soccer ball. And it weighs, what was it? I don't remember how many pounds, but 2 pounds or whatever. But, I ask, can you imagine a soccer ball of ice falling from the ground or the sky, you know? But I like to make it real for them and, you know, talk about those factors as well.
We're listening to Paul and Sarah there, and they're talking about the late afternoon and evening being the prime time when these storms occur. But also, there's a season to these storms. It's usually the springtime into the early summer. Where is the Tornado Alley, and why is it called Tornado Alley?
Well, it's actually two different alleys. I'll get back to the other one in a second. But Tornado Alley is generally from, it's just to the east of the Rockies. So the Rocky Mountains is kind of your divide through the centre of the US and all the way up to Canada. And the counties, or the states to the east of that, so Texas, Oklahoma, up to Alberta in Canada, that's Tornado Alley. And your strongest storms form in that region, generally from about late April to the middle of July, and it progresses further north. But before that, around this time of the year, between February and March, you tend to get more strong storms in what they call Dixie Alley, which is along the Gulf Coast, your Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Tennessee.
Arkansas,
yeah, as we saw recently, tornadoes went through Nashville, Tennessee, and unfortunately there was a quite large loss of life there. They can be very, very dangerous in this region because they can actually happen more often at night time and through the early hours of the morning.
So you can't even see them coming.
That's it,
in daylight. You just really need to have a radar or satellite picture.
Yeah, they rely so much on the weather forecaster giving the warning and sirens going off. So they have sirens in each town that they'll set off if there's a tornado coming.
So Tornado Alley, it's got these key ingredients.
Well, there's three main sources, really. Yeah. So you get a digging trough coming in on the west coast, bringing some cold air in from Oregon, Washington, places like that, down over the Rockies. And then you have dry air coming from the desert southwest regions, so over
like
New
Nevada,
Mexico and the Four Corners region, as they call it. So that's the key ingredient that we don't have here and other parts of the world. Bangladesh has it off the Himalayas, but
Australia as well a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
So that dry air, you're saying, that's kind of the big difference, say?
It is. The other aspect is they have the Gulf of Mexico, which is basically like a big soup pot. So you get a lot of warm, moist air rushing up on front of the Rocky Mountains. Now, the best concept here is to think of a pot of boiling water. You put a pot of boiling water on and you leave it, bubbles away, and it'll eventually bubble out. But if you put a top on that and you cover it over, what happens? The pressure builds up and it'll actually blow the top off it. if you keep boiling underneath. So what happens here is the warm, dry air comes off the desert out west, over the mountains, so it's pushed up above the surface and goes over the top of the moist air. That acts as a cap on top of that warming throughout the day. So as the sun shines, hits the ground, heats up the ground, you get turbulence at the surface, so you get that bubbling up like you get in the bottom of a pot, and that builds up and builds up. And if it holds throughout the day long enough, at some point the pressure will break and you'll get storms popping up. So it'll be a lovely sunny day and people are going, oh, what's this thunderstorm warnings? I don't understand it. And by about 4 or 5 o'clock in the evening, suddenly you get these storms firing up. And they're very, very strong because they've been building all day, all the energy's there, and they can explode upwards. So
if you didn't have that lid on the pot, so to speak, you may still be getting these clouds and storms popping up, but they're just not building up the same potential that they could if they were sort of being suppressed.
Exactly. Okay. The energy is there, and you might be getting thunderstorms throughout the day and lots of flooding and things like that. But they generally will not pose the same threat as storms as a day when you've got a strong cap, where, you know, just get one or two storms popping up through it late in the afternoon and the evening time.
You mentioned thunderstorms there. So just maybe to because I guess the basis of all these severe storms that you're looking for when you go storm chasing is based on a thunderstorm. What's the basis of their formation?
Well, that instability, that moisture. Basically, if you think of a hot air balloon, the hot air balloon, the air inside the balloon is much warmer than the air outside the balloon. That's what makes it rise. So it's just like that here. If you get that warm, moist air at the surface and you let it up, and there's colder air around it that's coming off the northwest, it's going to want to rise through that cold air. So the difference between the warm air at the surface and the cold air aloft, that instability, as we call it, that's what causes these thunderstorms to go up.
I think what it is like the question I think we're trying to get to is that basically we get thunderstorms here in Ireland, but they're not on the same level in any way of what they get in the United States, you know, in the springtime and early summer. But it is the same processes that form the thunderstorms in Ireland. Like this, the same kind of basic physics is the same. And some of the hazards are the same, like there's high intensity rainfall, there's hail, there's lightning, there's sometimes downdrafts and updrafts going on in that thunderstorm. But because Ireland and is a small island, we don't have a desert area, no. Certainly not. and we don't really have very high mountains to push the air up and increase the mid-levels. So we really just don't have the potential for these kind of supercell storms that form in the United States.
There's two different sides of it. So the instability I talked about a minute ago is really important. And we do get instability here, but it's nothing like the instability out in America. Or even if you think of down over Spain or Italy, if you've been on holidays during the summertime, you can get some nasty thunderstorms in the evening time there. In Ireland, we tend not to get that much instability. We get enough during the summer, we get a couple of days, we might get some decent enough thunderstorms, but not on the same level.
Sometimes I actually think our thunderstorms kind of more happen in the winter and spring, because we get an awful lot of hail sometimes in the winter. So, yeah, it's a different setup. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's it. Well, the key element there is people think you need to be very warm at the surface, but it's all the difference between the surface and up in the atmosphere. We get some very, very cold air come over higher up in the atmosphere over us during the winter time. And the difference between that, it never gets too cold here, usually, besides 2010 maybe. But you tend to get the difference between the slightly warmer surface temperatures and the cold air aloft. That's what causes the instability here during the winter time. During the summertime, we tend not to get much cold air coming over us at very high levels. So the difference between the surface and higher up is not as much. There is occasions we get them, and it gets quite interesting at times. But the other factor you mentioned for a supercell is not just the instability, but it's the turning of the winds that creates a rotational updraft. So basically, you're looking at the winds throughout the atmosphere. So at the surface, you might have a wind coming from the southeast. Up a little bit higher, it's coming from the south. A bit higher again, it's coming from the west. And at the top of the storm, it might be coming from the northwest. And all that acts to make like a corkscrew effect. So it's actually, the storm is twisting up. So the stronger the updraft pushes up through it, the more it'll spin. If you think of a ice skater, and an ice skater goes out and they're
they're flying around the ice and they stop and they spin. So they're spinning out, their arms out wide, and they're spinning. How do they make them spin faster? They pull their arms in close to themselves and they'll spin faster. If you think about the storm, the actual updraft is pushing up stronger and it's tightening in that storm as well. So because you've got that large scale energy is being now put into a smaller spatial area, the storm spins a bit faster. So the storm itself, to produce a tornado, works like that. The stronger the updraft pulls it in tighter and tighter and tighter. So you get a 1 or 2, 3 kilometer wide storm. Suddenly you're starting to get this little smaller tornado form in the middle of it.
Okay, so we have this almost on a bigger scale. Your whole thunderstorm is rotating, this supercell. And it that rotational energy gets essentially focused, is it, to form your tornado?
Yeah, so basically with the strong updraft and downdraft, as you make it, as it tightens in even more and more, you're going to increase that velocity upwards, so that updraft upwards. And again, thinking of the actual ice skater pulling their arms in, that's basically the effect that's happening there. The pressure drops close to the surface and a tornado starts to form underneath the actual main mesoscale updraft then.
Other than the tornado, obviously when we were out in the field, we there were other hazards we were looking out for. I mean, in the first the opening clip, we heard some really heavy hail. I mean, but hail is a fundamental part of a thunderstorm, right?
It is, and when we talk about hail in Ireland, we think of little small hard balls of ice that really hurt and sting you. When we talk about hail out in America, you do not want to be outside. Even some days you don't want to be in your car because it'll destroy your car. It'll break the windscreen. It'll dent every part of your car. Unfortunately, it can take the lives of animals out in the field and destroy crops as well. So it's a very dangerous thing to be around. The main reason for that ice getting so big is that as you've got this updraft going up, it's building ice. It's very cold air up there. So it's building ice on the actual raindrops. They're turning to ice and it starts to fall when it gets a bit heavier. But the updraft is so strong, it pushes it back up again. More ice forms in it, what we call riming. It comes down again and it keeps going up and down until it gets so heavy, it gets pushed out of the updraft and comes down ahead of the storm. And so the region around the updraft, just either side of the updraft, is usually where you get the strongest, the largest hail as well. And they can be up to 3, 4, 5, even 6 inches in diameter. Very, very big lumps of ice.
Yeah. So in a way, you're kind of looking for big hail so that you can kind of infer that there's a strong enough updraft to cause a tornado. So
yes.
So you're really looking, if you've got tennis ball sized hail, you feel like, oh, we're in the zone here.
if you've got tennis ball size hail, you know you're in the wrong zone.
yeah.
It's probably good for storm chasing, but not where you want to be. The interesting thing about a storm is that usually on where the warm, moist air is coming into the storm. Let's just say if a storm is going from the southwest to the northeast, it'll be on the southeast side. You tend to get what we call like a banana shape or a kind of hook shape on the storm. So to the southeast, generally it's quite dry and all of the hail and rain will fall on the northern side of that updraft, or just to the east of the updraft. Sometimes it wraps right back around the storm and you get what you call like a
donut?
It's a heavy precipitation storm where you actually get the rain and hail going around the whole tornado. So it's obscured. It's very, very dangerous for people in the line of these storms. They can't see them coming. A radar is very important. It's a very useful tool to get to a storm. It gives you about 5 minutes, an image of about 5 minutes ago. Unfortunately, these storms adapt so quickly that you have to learn to look at the storm to see what's going on, to be able to judge what it's doing. So for me, it's a fantastic laboratory as a meteorologist to go out and see what happens in the atmosphere, what's changing, what's the result of what I'm seeing and all these ingredients coming together.
What was the biggest size hail that you saw when you were out there?
When we were out there?
Yeah,
we actually, I think we're quite fortunate or unfortunate, depending on what you're hoping for. But hail-wise, I think we escaped fairly well. I mean,
I would call that fortunate,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. Down to, I think, you know, obviously good navigation by everyone involved.
That sounded awful in that clip.
It was heavy. It was large relative to what we would see in Ireland. And driving in it was kind of, particularly the first time, was like, wow, this is fairly intense. But then in saying that, you would park in a supermarket or something, and you would see a car that looks like it had been shot at, which had obviously gone through a real hailstorm. So I think we really didn't experience anything
well,
too impressive.
Well, it is America, so. Yeah. What size hailstones did you see on your trip?
I suppose in the largest, there was two particular storms that I really remember, but one of the biggest ones that we were actually driving through and had to slow down, I suppose you're talking about the size of maybe a €2 coin, something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, between it, one and €2 coin. We returned the car and there was no dents on it, so yeah, you're
because
bound
of course
to...
it's a rental car, so you really got to be careful,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. That's it. We tend to rent 4x4s out there, so we can handle any sort of terrain and get out of there pretty quickly. But yeah, you don't want to get it damaged and bring it back with hail dents in it. So it's very important to stay on the right side of the storm, but more so than that is to keep everybody in the car safe.
And did you see a tornado?
We did see a tornado on this trip, yeah. The way it turned out, there was quite a lot more tornadoes in May. Unfortunately, we couldn't go at that time, earlier in May. So it was kind of a quiet period, but we got a really, really nice storm in southwest Kansas. Mm-hmm. And the storm itself was absolutely beautiful to watch. When you get this rotation, you start getting what we call like stacked plates look. So you get these different layers. And it's amazingly beautiful, especially in the sunset. And we did get a brief little tornado out of that storm, and it wasn't too far away from us. So we got images of that. And in this case, it wasn't too bad. We knew exactly where it was going and what's going on. That's the
so
key for me.
Is power.
Yeah.
We saw some really. I mean, certainly for me, being my first time out there. As Paul said, not even so much the tornado, but the structure of these things. It is, they refer to these rotating supercells as motherships, you know, and it is that Independence Day moment, this enormous object coming across the sky. And because the planes are so flat there, you do have this impression that the sky is kind of so much bigger. And it's really imposing, these huge rotating creatures almost coming across the sky towards you. And it's hard to describe. But we did, obviously over there, one of the big things is photography. So we took lots of pictures and we'll aim to put those up on the website and on Instagram, and it'll be on my own Instagram and things like that. And little video clips as well. So you can really get a sense of kind of what we saw. The lightning as well was something that I had never seen lightning to that extent before.
Yeah, actually, when you get these storms, in their maturity, when they're very strong, the lightning can be like a strobe light. It's constantly going. And, you know, we just had to set our cameras up and just keep pressing, keep going. And we got some lovely lightning shots from that. So, yeah.
When I was talking with Paul and Sarah, they've obviously had years of experience in the field. And so I was asking them about some of their most memorable experiences that they've had when they were out storm chasing.
In 2002, we decided to take a trip out to the plains. My brother had just graduated from high school and he was thinking about going into meteorology. And we had talked about chasing storms in the plains for a long time. Didn't have a whole lot of money saved up. And so I had saved up a little bit and turned out to be a great trip. We got to get on a severe worn storm in northwest Arkansas that produced some small hail and some strong straight line winds. A little later, we got to see some storm structure, a big lowering. And that storm actually went tornado warned, but we didn't see anything with it. But I think the thing that sticks out is we had fun. We absolutely had a blast. We laughed, we joked, we teased each other. We had many long drives on family trips, so we had learned to get along in the car. And that's important if you're going to chase as a group, which I didn't mention this earlier, but some chasers prefer to chase alone because they don't deal well with trying to decide, you know, make decisions with another person. They like to call all their own shots, and I have great respect for those people. Other people prefer not to chase alone because it's another set of eyes for the road, for the sky, for everything. But we had so much fun on the trip, and I like to call it a glorified road trip, because we didn't have a destination. Wherever the wind took us, wherever the system took us, and we found ourselves in some very unusual towns and places, and came up, had these stories. And I said, Mark, I don't care if we never see a tornado. We have to come back out here and do this again. And so the next year we came out, saw our first tornado after dark.
And I was so excited to go because I have a degree in TV and radio production. And so the opportunity to get to film everything, and that just fascinated me. And it's not just, I mean, I love the storm, but I also love to video and take pictures of the people and how they react and interact. And sometimes I'll even interview local people because I just want to know what the average person knows or doesn't know, you know?
Do you normally get a good reaction from the locals when you speak to them when you're out chasing?
Depends on where you're at. Generally, usually there's a story, and sometimes the story can be embellished. one guy, he was talking about how he was driving to pick his daughter up, and the tornado was 10 miles high and like half a mile wide, and then picked his car up and spun him a few 360s and threw him into a ditch. And like, it's just like, okay, right? But it's fascinating just to hear their point of view. And then some people actually have really good stories. And I really want to know their stories, you know, especially the survivor stories of where they had to take cover or, you know, something like that. It's just, it's good.
We were on this storm, pretty high based, and watching it, dropping some very large hail. In fact, we had already come across some storm chasers who had lost windows due to tennis ball size hail. And so we were trying to stay south of this storm, and we were out in this field watching, and this guy drove up in a pickup, got out, had a big cowboy hat on, got out. You guys storm watchers? Yes, sir. We're out here watching this storm, he said. All right. Well, you know, he'd sat there and talked with us for a few minutes. He said, well, I got to get on, but y'all be safe. Y'all be careful. And we decided to reposition.
We had to reposition because we, on both ends of the road we were on, there were reports of baseball-sized hail. So that only left one direction to find another road in the middle of where we were.
Yeah, we were on a ranch road, and it was pretty good condition for being a dirt road. But we tried to make an escape back to the highway, and we started seeing these hail bombs explode on the road ahead of us. And we were in a rental vehicle, and we really didn't want to lose a window or, you know, get some damage. So we tracked back and went south, and we lost our information. We lost our map information, started just feeling our way through the roads and looking for a place to take shelter or get free.
And we also had cows in front of us. They were like, ah, come on, cows, move out of the way.
Finally came across a ranch house, and it had some trees, and we thought we could park up under the trees, but it was gated, and it was gated shut. And we made the decision to sometimes it's easier to ask forgiveness later than to ask permission. Yes, we don't do this often, but we trespassed, and we opened the gate, pulled in, and turns out that rancher was home, and saw their silhouette in the window. We were parked in their driveway, and they were waving at us. I thought they were upset, but it turns out they were waving us in, and so we ran up to the door. And it turns out it was the rancher we had met earlier. Had no idea that's where he lived, and he was awesome. He let us come in, gave us coffee. He shared his story of a tornado that he had seen several years back, and he was a great storyteller. He sort of rescued us because just probably less than a mile north of where his house was, after the fact, a good 2 hours after the fact, we were driving back, you know, picking our way back out, and came across very large piles of hail floating in the road. And we stopped and found some hailstones that were still tennis ball size in these crater holes in the ground. So we knew it had been larger. And so sometimes you just really appreciate the people you meet. We stayed in contact with them since that time, and it's been a great experience.
So do you guys have a particular chase that sticks out in your memory? Is there a chase that had the strongest impact, or something that you go to when you think about a memorable day out on the road?
Yeah, I would definitely say Greensburg, Kansas in 2007. That had a huge impact, because up until that point, we had seen tornadoes. Even in some storms, we'd seen several tornadoes. It would just put tornado down, like after another. But Greensburg, Kansas, that was the first time we saw damage to that degree, to that level. The tornado was 1.7 miles wide, and it clean slated 95% of the town. We had not seen that level before. And so that was, I was in shock for a month after that, just taking that in. In 2007, that was the first time we ever went to the Storm Chasers Convention. We met this group called the Mezzo Group, and a lot of them were firefighters and EMTs. This particular day, the Mezzo Group was northeast, but we kind of stayed south. We were just debating, and I'll let Paul tell a little bit about what his thoughts were.
We knew that the day had potential early on to be a big day, but it was one of those question mark days. We had stayed the night in Dodge City and driven through Greensburg, Kansas, earlier in the day to Pratt, Kansas, and watching storms struggle to get going. And so we stopped for lunch, and just as we were wrapping up lunch, this one little cell went up further south. We had been on the fence. Do we stay up here or do we drop south? And so this cell went up, and we watched one more scan to make sure it was going to survive, and said, that's it. We've got to get down there. Well, that storm actually produced the Arnett, Oklahoma tornado, this really tall stovepipe tornado, really photogenic. And we did not get on it in time to see that. But on our way down, we actually saw these towers that were with these what we call left split storms, where you have a storm that splits and the southern one kind of takes a right turn and the northern one shoot off to the north. And there were three towers. And I took note of them, but didn't think too much about them. And then we continued on, got on the Arnett storm near Woodward, Oklahoma, very late, beautiful LP supercell, low precipitation supercell, spinning like a top. And we did a little time lapse of it, and we watched it almost completely evaporate before we decided all that, those little left splits, that energy had congealed into one storm and was developing rapidly and moving north. And so we made the decision to try and get on that storm, hopefully before dark, and started racing north. And one mistake we made that day, We were in Woodward, and we got out of Woodward before we took stock of our gasoline. We were short on fuel, and so we started looking for fuel, and we learned very quickly there aren't very many fuel stops between Woodward and Greensburg. And we're watching this storm, and it had amazing structure and it's just insane lightning, and looking at it on radar, and we're thinking it's going to produce a tornado. It's definitely going to produce a tornado. Can we get on it in time? And just as we're about to come into this town of Coldwater, which is just a little southwest of Greensburg, there was a lightning flash that illuminated a very large tornado underneath the base, you know, a wedge-type tornado, wider than it was tall. And Mark and I looked at each other and said, was that what I think it was? And we had to stop for gas. We had to stop for fuel. It was driving us crazy. And I remember we stopped and everybody was running around. And it was one of those old style pumps. You had to pay inside. And the guy was taking his time. And I thought, there is no way. It's going to be done. The show's going to be over by the time this is over.
Yeah, the guy inside was like, yeah, there's reports that there might be a tornado, but I don't know. And we're like, yes, yes, there is. But while they were pumping the gas, I took everybody's cell phones because I didn't have very good service. And the last time I had heard from Randy Denzer and the Mezzo group, they were heading south towards the storm on 183. And from the north side of the storm, if there was a lot of rain, they wouldn't see it. They would just drive into it. So I was frantically trying to find one cell phone that would get a text message or a phone call. And I got a phone call using Paul's phone and called them and said, there is a tornado headed towards 183, at least half a mile wide. And, you know, just call me when you get this message to let us know you're okay.
We got on the road. We got kind of up, I think we had to go over a couple of hills and got within view, and the lightning illuminated the largest tornado I'd ever seen to that point in my life. I mean, at that point, it probably was more than a mile wide, and we found a spot to stop on the side of the road. We decided we didn't really want to get closer than where we were, and took video with the lightning illuminating this very, very large tornado. And it was 2 hour northwest, I believe, at the time, moving northeast, and still out in open country. And so we were again elated. We were jumping up and down and trying. I mean, I try not to yell a lot now, because you go back and listen in the video and you say, I would rather listen to the storm. Plus, it makes you sound like you've never seen a tornado before. And I really don't do that much anymore. But at the time, we were just in awe. But no, we were very excited until it suddenly hit us that this storm had turned and was going straight for Greensburg, the town we had driven through. And so once it had moved further north, we decided to proceed further to the north.
So me being the videographer, I would usually film everything. I would zoom in on the, you know, the tornado and stuff. At this point, I had not heard from the Mezzo group. So I gave my video camera and to my brother Mark and said, you film it. I'm just going to stay here with all the cell phones and wait for them. Like, I was praying, God, please let them be okay. Like for real, like praying so much. And then the tornado crossed 183 and was heading northeast at that time. And my phone said no service, but I got a phone call from Randy Denzer. Like, that was just God right there. And he was like, and I was so happy. I'm glad you're okay. He said that they pulled off on the side of the road because they got our message about the tornado.
It was very surreal coming across the damage path, because there were these houses, and this was not in Greensville proper. This was southwest of town, this little farming community, houses that were impacted. And we came across this natural gas pumping station that had been hit and was just squealing at this high pitch. I've never heard anything like it. And I'm thinking natural gas is more dense than the surrounding air. There's probably a pool of it here, and it's still lightning around here. I really don't feel good about just being right here. But it was just no light, was except for the lightning and this high squealing noise. And we even heard cattle that had been affected and were making really horrific noises. You knew some cattle were dying. And we started trying to pick our way through downed power lines, driving. And at one point we just decided we can't get through here. We're going to have to backtrack and go around and make our way back to Dodge City the long way, which was like another hour and a half it ended up being. But we ended up getting back together with the Randy and their team after the fact. And they told us what eventually happened for them. And basically, they were on the northwest side of the storm, coming south. They made a general practice of not chasing after dark, but this was late in the season. They hadn't had a lot of success. they decided, let's do it. We'll just try and be careful. And the storm had basically started to turn back to the north as the tornado was going through town. So they really didn't have any visibility at all. And the tornado tracked through town, and it actually, by the time it impacted town, it was traveling north-northwest and then tracked back to the northwest, back across 183 and did a curlicue. It crossed 183 twice. And they had been north of that spot where the tornado crossed the road that they were on when they got our information that it had already crossed 183. They went south. The tornado track actually tracked back over the area that they had been sitting parked. So our communication with them that it had crossed 83 allowed them to move south and out of the path of potentially out of the path of the tornado. What ended up happening was that they reached the intersection of 183 and 54, I think it is, which is west of town, about a mile west of town, and the fire chief was sitting there at the corner, just in shock. Yeah, and Randy approached, you know, rolled the window down and asked the guy where is where's the fire station in town? And the guy said, it's gone. Everything's gone. And because he said because I've got a report that there are some houses south of town that got hit. And this guy says, well, the whole town is gone. So they immediately went into first responder triage type mode and allowed the guy to take them into town, and they started setting up things. And it was good for the town of Greensburg because they were the first on scene. And they had people who were medically trained and trained in first responder, setting up all that organization of search and rescue. And I think they were at it until 3 or 4 in the morning, just trying to help people.
Yeah, I was going to say the fire chief was in shock, according to Randy. And when he found out that he was the fire chief, he said, well, let's just go, you know, we'll pick you up and take you in and get some of your trucks to help these people who have been hit. And he was like, you don't understand. The fire department is gone. The hospital's gone. I don't know where my family is. Like, he was just totally in shock.
And just some information. That town, I think it had a population of about 1,200 people at the time. And 12 people in town lost their lives, and one gentleman lost his life. I believe he was a police officer who realized there was another tornado that spawned from this storm headed towards his hometown, and he raced off to try and warn his family and drove into the path of the tornado. So all in all, 13 out of 1,200, no loss of life is acceptable, but the limiting of loss of life is what the National Weather Service is all about. And I give props to Mike Umscheid, the weather forecast meteorologist on duty in Dodge City, for issuing a tornado emergency a full 45 minutes before the tornado hit the town. People actually took shelter, and I think that was a huge part of the limiting of the loss of life in that town. We talked to a survivor just a few days ago, and she remarked that the town really hadn't been directly affected by a tornado in her memory prior to that. So this was not something that they were totally prepared for, but because of the National Weather Service, the diligent work and everyone involved, a lot more loss of life was possible. One thing that storm chasers will invariably come across, have to deal with if they chase long enough years, is the impact that tornadoes and other severe types of weather can have on a community. And one moment a storm chaser can be elated and just excited for making a good forecast, positioning and seeing what Mother Nature is producing, and the next minute realizing it's about to impact quite a few people, go through a populated area, and something that we never wish happens, never hope happens. In fact, we hope the opposite. And so A storm chaser is going to invariably have to deal with some emotions because I come to a realization I'm celebrating something that changes someone's life forever. And is that okay? Is it okay that I was celebrating seeing something that, you know, affected somebody? And you have to come to terms, and it takes some time, but for me, I had to come to terms with the sense that, first of all, whether I was there or not, that tornado was going to touch down. It was going to impact those people. The fact that I was there put me in a position to contact the National Weather Service and let them know that this is actually happening. It's on the ground. Give them some ground truth. It gives us the opportunity to learn more about those types of storms. And I actually read where somebody was interviewed from Greensburg, who actually expressed appreciation that somebody had taken a picture of this entity that had actually completely changed their life. And so all of those things go into realizing that, it's okay to enjoy experiencing this thing that Mother Nature produces. It doesn't mean that you're celebrating how it negatively affects, you know, a community.
I know that tornadoes and they're basically nature's most violent storms. The highest wind speeds ever recorded on Earth have been inside a tornado. So what's the highest wind speed that was ever recorded inside a tornado?
302 miles an hour in Moore, Oklahoma, in May 1999.
How do they measure that?
They measure that with Doppler radar. So by looking at radar, we're used to looking at radar for rainfall and seeing how the rainfall goes. But you can actually look at wind speeds as well. So they looked at that and they could see the difference between the strongest inflow and outflow winds. So they get one example from that. That was where they got the specific wind speed from. But in reality, wind measurements can't be taken from these storms very easily. So we look at damage instead. So they're measured by how much damage they do. Now, it's a pretty broad scale looking at this, but anything over 200 miles an hour is called an EF5 or Enhanced Fujita Scale, level 5, category 5. So that is the extreme, and that will destroy your house, clean off its foundations, and it's a very, very dangerous situation to be in. And below that, then you've got, you know, EF4, EF3, EF2, EF1, and EF0. EF0 is kind of along the lines of what you might see on the rare occasion there is a tornado in Ireland. It's usually, you know, about, I think it's 70 to 100 miles an hour. So kind of like a very, very strong gust during a winter storm here. It'll take down some trees. It'll take some roofs off houses, maybe off sheds, things like that. So it's an engineering scale. So they look at buildings and they go, okay, well, we've tested this building at such and such a wind speed, and it was broken up at this wind speed. So we're going to infer that from the damage done to this house, this would be the wind speed. So they'll use wind tunnels and the like to measure how different types of materials react in certain wind speeds. They look at, for instance, shards of wood going through a wall, what sort of wind speed is necessary to force it through a wall. And if they see that in the actual field, then they can say, okay, that's EF2, EF3, things like that.
And something you mentioned there, you can have these cases where one structure will be severely damaged and the other will be left okay. And that's down to these sort of small little like mini tornadoes within the larger tornado, isn't that right?
Yes. So the larger these tornadoes get, sometimes you get what you call vortex breakdown. So you get smaller little tornadoes that spin around the main one. And they can generate very, very strong wind speeds over, you know, down to a couple of meters in wide. So I've been in a house that was destroyed, one half the house gone. The other half the house, you have the dinner table set, ready for dinner. Nothing touched. It's eerie to see. Very wow. Eerie.
And just to clarify as well, Paul, I mean, there are obviously a lot of very severe weather events. You know, we hear of hurricanes and tornadoes, and these are very different things. Obviously, they're different scales, right?
Yeah, and they can often get mistaken, actually. When I say I chase tornadoes, people kind of, you know, if they hear of a hurricane, they're like, well, you're not chasing that. I talked about the width of a
a thunderstorm being, you know, 1 to 2 kilometers wide, maybe three, four kilometers wide. A hurricane, it can be hundreds of kilometers wide. It's a very large system. Now, it can have embedded tornadoes very, very close to the eye wall as well. But for the actual the scale we look at for hurricanes, we talk about a category 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
It's a Saffir-Simpson scale.
Exactly, yeah.
Whereas the scale we look at for a tornado is
Fujita, or the enhanced Fujita scale.
And obviously, if you want to know more about hurricanes, we dug into that in detail in
episode three.
Yeah, check that out. The town that Paul and Sarah spoke of, Greensburg, that was actually on the route that we took while we were over there. So we had a chance to visit and to see how it looked almost exactly 12 years to the day from when the storm had hit. And even now, there's still very clear evidence of the damage that storm has caused. I think the thing that stuck with me the most was there was a set of steps leading up to a house, except the house was no longer there. As Paul mentioned earlier, like, the foundations had been completely swept clean, and there's just these brick steps leading up to an empty space. And I mean, the level of damage that was done was incredible. I mean, this tornado was something like 2.7 kilometers wide. It wiped out like 95% of the town. But so many of the residents survived because of a really good warning system, right? They were able to warn them something like 45 minutes before.
Yeah, yeah. One of my friends actually was on the forecast desk in the local weather station for that. And they had a very good warning out ahead of time, and people could actually leave the town and get away from the town prior to the tornado hitting. There's a lot of questions about, you know, how much time is too much time even for a warning in this stage. But a lot of people got out of the town, and it saved their lives, basically. It went right through the middle of town and absolutely wiped it off the map. And unfortunately, there was loss of life with that storm.
So when you guys visited, was the damage still there, or like, have they been able to rebuild? Or
so that's really interesting, because they have, because many of the residents, as Paul said, there was loss of life, which was terrible, but many of the residents did survive, and they decided if they were going to rebuild their city, they had an opportunity to have a real input into the plans for a new town, and they've decided they've wanted to build it as sustainably and as environmentally friendly as possible. Exactly, as a green town. So in sort of the visitor center that we saw while we were there, they had laid out the plans that they were hoping to use, you know, as much renewable energy as possible, as much sustainable building methods as possible. And it's a really, they've taken a positive out of what was a really horrific event.
We could all learn a lot from how they bounce back and the way they're looking at living from a greener perspective, for sure.
I guess the big question is, will you guys go again?
Well,
no.
Would you go again?
I know for sure.
They're going to hold you to it.
I know for sure that Paul will go again. I would love to go again. As I said, it was something that I had always wanted to do, and, you know, sort of going around the fields in Sligo, pretending and hoping that a thunderstorm is going to produce a tornado. It doesn't really cut it anymore.
Oh, I can see it now.
Yeah, exactly. It's happened. So I think I will definitely we'll head out again. And I think probably a little wiser as well, in terms of, you know, definitely learn some lessons out there, thanks to, you know, the experience that Paul has and the others that we were with. I mean, you know, I've obviously all of our backgrounds is meteorology, but this is such a specific science, and it's almost an art as well, as I think Paul and Sarah mentioned. There's only certain things that you can learn from experience. And I'm sure, Paul, the more you've gone out, you see something new every time, I'm sure.
Definitely. And it's very humbling, because as meteorologists, I think someone said to me once that the more you learn, the more you realize you don't know. So you always have to be humble and have your eyes open and watch what's going on and learn something every time you go out. But also, like, you know, we're usually sitting in front of computer screens, looking at models, looking at data coming in. Having the ability to be out there in the field, watching the storm develop, watching weather work,
watching physics in action.
Absolutely, yes.
It is amazing.
It's absolutely amazing to see. And
no matter how realistic your model is, it's never, you know, it can
never capture that.
It can never capture that. Yeah. It'll always be slightly wrong.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just, you start to realize,
or very wrong.
You start to realize how small scale it works. Our computer models, we look at you know, kilometer boxes and larger than that. Whereas this is down to a couple of meters. It's very, very small, and even smaller than that. So this gives you an idea of the complexity and the challenges we have as forecasters to forecast the weather based on these little small little changes that can happen that can build up into something as big as a tornado.
Well, thanks very much for coming in, Paul. It was, as I said, it was a pleasure chasing storms with you, and we'll hopefully get back out there again sometime soon.
Yeah, I'm not sure about this year, but maybe next year, for sure.
For our climate summary this month, Paul Moore has the details on how our weather has been this past winter.
Here are the highs and lows for the winter season, December 2019 and January-February 2020, based on data from MetEireann's 25 synoptic weather stations. The winter was warmer and wetter than average everywhere in Ireland. The dominant feature for the season for the Northern Hemisphere was a strong stratospheric polar vortex, well coupled with the troposphere, which led to the Arctic Oscillation and North Atlantic Oscillations being in a positive phase through most of the winter. The knock-on effect for Ireland and much of northwestern Europe was a mostly mobile westerly flow off the Atlantic, with a strong jet stream feeding in numerous low-pressure systems. Six named storms affected Ireland through the season. February in particular saw extreme cyclogenesis in the North Atlantic, leading to the development of numerous vigorous storm systems, several of which affected Ireland, including three named storms. This included one of the deepest mid-latitude storms ever recorded in the Northern Hemisphere, Storm Dennis. This led to an exceptionally wet and windy month in Ireland, where 16 of our synoptic stations recorded their wettest February on record, and 11 stations recorded their windiest February on record. This resulted in a lot of flooding, especially along the Shannon catchment. The sunniest place for the winter season was in the southeast, where Johnstown Castle recorded 237 hours of sunshine, 37% above average. Belmullet in County Mayo was the dullest place, with 133 hours of sunshine, 10% below average. The wettest place for the season was Newport, County Mayo, with 702.8 millimetres of rainfall, which is 48% above average. The driest place was Dublin Airport, with 224.1 millimetres, which is 21% above average. The wettest day of the season was at Knock Airport, County Mayo, on the 8th of February, with 51.5 millimetres of rainfall. The highest mean temperature for the season was on Sherkin Island, County Cork, with a mean temperature of 8.2 degrees Celsius, which is 0.5 degrees Celsius above its average. While the lowest seasonal mean temperature was 4.8 degrees Celsius at Knock Airport, which is 0.6 degrees Celsius above its average. The highest temperature for the season was 14.4 degrees Celsius and was reported at Newport in County Mayo on the 7th of January. The lowest temperature was reported at Mullingar, County Westmeath on the 19th of January with -6.1 degrees Celsius. Storm force winds were reported on 8 days during the season. Globally, for surface air temperatures, February was the second warmest February on record behind 2016. The winter in Europe was by far the warmest winter on record, 1.4 degrees Celsius warmer than the previous warmest winter of 2015-2016. And 3.4 degrees Celsius above the 1981 to 2010 average.
Thanks for that, Paul.
Well, that's all we have time for today. Our thanks again to Paul Downs and Paul and Sarah Austin for joining us this month, Alan Bennett at Headstuff, and the communications team at MetEireann and at the Department of Housing, Planning and Local Government.
Thanks for tuning in. And as always, you can find more information about today's topic on our webpage at met.ie/podcast. And as mentioned, we'll be posting pictures and videos from our storm chasing trip on Instagram and on our webpage over the coming days.
You can subscribe to the podcast on the webpage or wherever you normally get your podcasts from, and get in touch with us using the MetEireann Twitter and Facebook pages using the hashtag MetEireann Podcast, or by emailing us at podcast@met.ie. Thanks for all your comments and suggestions so far.
Playing us out this month are the MetEireann Choir, the Isobars, with their rendition of Keep on the Sunny Side. We hope you'll join us next time, but until then, thanks for listening.
And take care.
There's a dark and a troubled side of life. There's a bright and a sunny side too. Though we meet with the darkness and strife, the sunny side we also may view. On the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way if we keep on the sunny side of life. hopes that we cherish so dear. Clouds and storms will in time pass away, and the sun again will shine bright and clear. Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way if we keep on the sunny side of life. Keep on the sunny side.